So I go up to this man and I was like, I promise if you write about our story, we will get the story into the front page of the Sunday Times in a couple of weeks. A couple of weeks, we're front page of the Sunday Times, right? And I think it was one of those things. We were kids just like raising our head above the parapet, right? Like no one was speaking about it. So, you know, 2 years down the line, we were advising the government. We actually ended up getting mental health education into every school nationwide. And at that point, I really thought I'd solved the problem. So I think maybe naive, but I was like, I've done it. You know, no, all the kids are going to be healthy and well now. And I left the space for 8 years. I built other tech companies, became an Instagram influencer. I did everything. And then came back to London about 2022 from the US and was like, I haven't fucking solved this problem at all.
Sophia Parvizi-Wayne, welcome to the Everyday Founder.
Thank you.
Social media pins you down as a semi-retired athlete and founder of a mental health startup. Oh. From doing your own battles, also running your own tech startup. Today, you run Kanjo Health. Run me through what Kanjo Health is.
I'm first interested where, did that come from my Instagram? The semi-retired athlete. Yeah, I am a semi-retired athlete. Kanjo is the first pre-diagnostic mental health app that uses basically large LLMs for WRT analysis. So we look at early diagnosis of autism, ADHD, and some of the other, you know, biggest neurodiversity problems we're currently facing.
Amazing. So if I'm looking at it from a customer, a user point of view, how can Kanjo help me?
Yeah, you're not a user, you're not a clinician.
Okay.
That's unless true. You have a PhD that I'm like unaware of. We basically allow clinicians to save about 40 hours of time per patient by basically collecting empirical truths in data. So we know that there are truths within genetic, maternal, and environmental factors that can indicate a diagnosis. Currently, we have an 80% misdiagnosis of mental health conditions. That's over, under, and missed. What we do is we basically aggregate all this data, pull all those truths out of it, and per patient give risk analytics, comorbidity analytics, and then a generative AI-based tools that allow them to kind of do that end-to-end care, but starting from like a personalized spot. And I think, you know, we've seen a lot of clinician co-pilot tools coming out at the moment, but most of them are transcribing notes or, you know, back office stuff, which can make a lot of money, but doesn't actually solve the problem from the word go.
Awesome. So there's a significant misdiagnosis. This is an instance where somebody is potentially diagnosed late with a mental health issue or illness, but also potentially not diagnosed at all.
Exactly.
How did this start? Like, why did you get involved with mental health startups and also then the clinician side as well?
Yeah, so my journey in mental health started about 10 years ago, which is a very long time when you're 27. It's almost half my life, but I was initially the patient. So when I was 16, I was diagnosed with anorexia nervosa. I lost about 40% of my body weight in 12 months following the loss of a friend. And kind of around that time realized, whilst I love my school, my alma mater are great, schools weren't doing enough in mental health. Basically, they were doing fuck all. And as a 16-year-old with my best friend, Amber, who's visiting London this weekend, we decided to start a campaign to get mental health on the national curriculum. We had fuck all idea what we were doing. We were like, what does a campaign look like? And she was like, write down all these journalists in a notebook. We're going to email all of them. And while we were doing this with no idea what we were going to do, we heard this kind of journalist interviewing someone in a cafe. And Amber was like, go on, speak to him. And I was like, what do I say? And she was like, just tell him we are going to launch the biggest campaign the UK has ever seen. And I was like, ambitious, we're 16, but okay. So I go up to this man and I was like, I promise if you write about our story, we will get the story into the front page of the Sunday Times in a couple of weeks. A couple of weeks, we're front page of the Sunday Times, right? And I think it was one of those things. We were kids just like raising our head above the parapet, right? Like no one was speaking about it. So, you know, 2 years down the line, we were advising the government. We actually ended up getting mental health education into every school nationwide. And at that point, I really thought I'd solved the problem. So I think maybe naive, but I was like, I've done it. You know, no, all the kids are going to be healthy and well now. And I left the space for 8 years. I built other tech companies, became an Instagram influencer. I did everything. And then came back to London about 2022 from the US and was like, I haven't fucking solved this problem at all. And ultimately that was because we hadn't looked at prevention. We hadn't looked at personalization. And realistically where system, like most change is needed is in within the system, and that's healthcare. And that's kind of how we decided not to go B2C and sell to parents, but instead actually solve the problems clinicians needed to be solved.
So let's look exactly at that, right? So B2C, B2B. Kanjo at one point was B2C focused,
yeah,
right?
Mistake.
So mistake, you say, but it's the logical step, right? You go to the root of the problem. It's the person themselves. They are having challenges that they maybe don't even know why something's happening to them, or potentially what's going on, really, whether that be the parent or the child or adult themselves. B2C seems pretty logical, but then
I had that feeling too.
You pivoted away. Talk me through that sort of transition between like B2C, obvious route to many,
yeah,
but actually we end up in B2B.
Look, I think the first thing was pretty much on the problem that we're solving is for families, right? Was we can deliver all these insights to parents, but what do they do with them? Right, like the issue isn't, I personally believe parents' intuition is very strong most of the time. They are still not the one making the diagnosis. That is where the issue lies. Right, parents can't solve the issue of a 12 to 24 month waiting list in the NHS for mental health conditions, right? They might get in there, they'll get their wait 12 months and then get a misdiagnosis and that kid is stuck, right? That, even if we give them support tools, which we still do, by the way, but we do it through the clinicians. So we give it free for parents now. Am I solving the problem that they need solved? No. The second is we were building gaming tools. I'm not a gaming founder. I do not like games at all. And like, it took me about a year to admit that, but you know, I'd go to all these gaming dinners and like, you know, they were all talking about like all these weird metrics I'd never heard of. And I was just like, I'm not going to be the best at this. And the third was, honestly, consumers very expensive, right? As in our customer acquisition rates were significantly higher and there was enormous willingness to pay from clinicians. And I think you follow what the market tells you to do. And you follow the need, right? And the need was ultimately, we are solving the same problem for the same people, but we're actually solving it from the root.
For sure. I mean, I think if you're a parent or an adult or whoever it may be, you go to a clinician and you just assume that they are the ones that are going to give you the 100% diagnosis, which you believe is going to be the correct one. But as you say, if there's a 12-month wait list and then they get a wrong diagnosis, the setback might be huge and very impactful to that person.
And I think, look, my dad's a doctor. I think doctors are the most important people we have in this country. And my job is never to replace a clinician's job. It's to make their job easier. Right. So what we do is we're giving them all this information they can't do themselves. We are helping them, you know, figure out how to triage more appropriately and saving them time and saving them money. Like there are things doctors can do that AI will never be able to do. Right. Which is, when you do assessment tools, yes, you need what we do, which is, you know, data like genetic, maternal, environmental, but symptomology is really important, right? So you can gauge how I am walking into a room by the way my posture is or the way my voice is, right? We can tell mood pretty quickly from like syntax. AI can't replace that. Like you can't replace human interaction or understanding how a child interacts with the parents or their school teacher. Our job is not to replace, it's to facilitate. And I think that's been really important.
Yeah, so I obviously am on board with this. It makes complete sense to me. Do you get any friction? Friction from the clinician side. I mean, at the end of the day, these individuals have gone through years of training.
Yeah.
They have been told how to do their jobs. And then technology, and this may be the same for any industry where technology advances and then we need to adopt it. Have you receiving any frictions from clinicians in terms of like your tool and Kanjo?
Yeah, so in the Middle East, certainly not. And the rationale for that is there's been an 1,000% increase in the last 5 years for people looking for a diagnosis, kind of where we were 15 to 20 years ago, right? But they don't have the clinicians on the ground, right? They're mostly, you know, they fly in a lot of US clinicians, a lot of UK clinicians, and there is a big impetus to get those clinicians trained. They see us as a clinician training tool, right? So actually for them, there has been very little resistance. In the UK and in the Middle East, stakeholder management is probably my number one job. Right. So, you know, there is an ultimate fear of AI and tech coming for their jobs. You know, what's the most cost effective? There are a lot of questions. And I think for us is being like, we are building this with doctors for doctors. Tell us what you need to be done. Right. So one thing we never even thought about was tracking tools. Right. So it's, we know that sleep, food and mood, you know, affects the diagnosis longitudinally. And currently the way clinicians, the only way they can track it is, you know, every couple of weeks when a patient comes in, they go, how was your sleep? Right? Or did you have a diary where you checked your food? Us digitalizing that for them and tracking it for them, it was like the easiest solution that tied into our model and made our model better. So I think for us, it's being like, if you don't want it, we're not going to build it. Right? And I think that's been the biggest thing is, and we've seen it in healthcare a lot, there are so many healthcare companies. So clinicians don't want half of those tools. They build what they need.
Sure. So then let's talk about that then. So your customer is a clinician. How are you acquiring customers if we're looking at
I'm
it from
a... I'm a great saleswoman.
You're a great saleswoman.
What could I say? So we predominantly work in the Middle East for a number of reasons, but we initially were backed by the government there and the Abu Dhabi Investment Office, which really did help. And I think for us, what you need to do to acquire any form of clinician is relationships, right? And it's the same with anything in B2B SaaS. My job is not to, you know, get 2 million likes on Instagram. Like, that's not my need. I would love that though, it'd be such fun. My job is to make these people trust me, right? And trust that we are the best solution for them. So, you know, a lot of my time and a lot of my team's time is on, we still do like hundreds of customer validation calls being like, what do you think of this product? How would you use this? You know, how much are you currently spending? That gradually converts to sales because we end up building what they want.
Love that. Let's talk about that then. You just said your majority in the Middle East, Dubai is your office out there. You're in London right now.
I'm in London.
How is it running a global company, predominantly 7-hour, 5-hour, 7-hour flight away, time zone difference, etc.? How's that?
Well, I spend a lot of time on back row economy, like a lot. And the chair doesn't go all the way back, so you're consistently sitting like trying to sleep like this on red eyes. I split my time. So I'm there a lot. And I think, and I spoke about this recently in Saudi, I have a slight issue with, you know, there's a lot of US companies and a lot of UK companies that suddenly have decided that the Middle East is the perfect place to build. A lot of these companies can't raise here, right? Or it hasn't worked here. And then they go to the Middle East and they're like, we have this amazing solution for you. And they assume they're stupid and they're suddenly going to be like, yep, it makes sense. It does, like, localization does not mean take the product you have and just drop it in another country and assume that it works. Like, it is very much like, build what these people want, use people on the ground, and like, build a solution for that region. And that is exactly what we did. So about 7 months ago, I started working with the Abu Dhabi government, the Early Childhood Authority. We got investment from the Abu Dhabi basically ended up doing quite well. And what I learned was kind of the problems I told you about. It was, they are in the beginning of a mental health crisis. Every country has been, right? We see, you know, prevalence rates of ADHD at 6-7% globally. They're expected in MENA at 18%, right? So it's a significant problem. And then it came to, okay, we're seeing so much willingness to pay. What do we need to do? We need to actually spend so much time out there and figure out exactly what they want. When it comes to markets, like, it's an enormous market. Like, we forget about it, but like, it's quite funny, you know, funds and people will try and go out there and raise money and not want to build there. That's been like a really interesting thing. And I'm like, you're neglecting how important this region is. And I'm saying that as someone who's, you know, from that region.
Yeah. Love that. But let's talk about yourself then. So you went from...
My favorite thing to do.
Yeah. You went from being 15, 16, dealing with anorexia to currently in 2024... I read that you recently sort of discovered that you have ADHD. Got the whole bag. Talk me through how you kind of came to that realization whilst running a business which supports people like yourself.
Yeah. So I've actually had 3 ADHD diagnoses at this point. So my first was, I was 20 and my college coach wanted me to go and get tested for ADHD. And I was like, I mean, I'm studying fine and, you know, I hyper-focus. And the last thing you give someone who has had an eating disorder is Adderall, right? It restricts your appetite. Like, the whole thing just would not make sense. So I went and got it. And, you know, I did all these BP tests and they were like, you don't have ADHD. And I was like, okay, I'll just like keep going with my life. And then kind of as I started building out my companies, I kept having this like bizarre feeling of overwhelm. And like, overwhelmed for some people is like, you just feel overwhelmed. For me, it's like, I go into complete overdrive, particularly when times are hard and it's something I have to manage. So a good example is, you know, I went through a breakup a couple of years ago with a long-term boyfriend. And in the months coming up to that, every morning I was up at 4 or 5 and I go for a run and then I go straight to work and then I go for another run. Then I keep working. And then 11, a friend would text me and say, do you want to go out? And I was like, yep, I'll go out. I come back at 2 and then I'd wake up at 4. And it was like, my way of processing was like, I'm just going to go into absolute overdrive. I was doing that for months. And at some point I went to see my therapist, who I've been seeing for 10 years. And she was like, do I need to tell you? And I was like, what do you mean? And then she was like, Sophia, it's quite obvious you have ADHD. She was like, high functioning for sure. You know, you're not the kid who's, you know, running around in circles.
Sure.
But what you're doing is the equivalent of running around in circles, right? It's like, you are just going to burn yourself to the ground. And, you know, went through the process. Obviously I have ADHD. But I think what was really important in that process was like my misassumption of manifestations of ADHD and what that would look like. You know, I assumed that I would not be able to focus the whole time, and that's what would lead me to have ADHD. Like, it's not that, right? And it made a lot more sense when it came to my eating disorder or my compulsive behaviors, because they're also tied. I'm the most compulsive person you will ever meet. You laugh, but if you ask anyone, talk to Sophia about chewing gum. So good example, I became addicted to chewing gum. I was on 8 packs a day for 5 years.
Wow.
Yeah. Like stomach ulcers, everything. I spent $3,500 per year on chewing gum, which is crazy. Yeah.
Wow.
And, you know, running, another one for me. Obviously, I was an athlete, but there is a thing that I feel terrible if I don't do it.
Hmm.
Eating, can I be the best at not eating? Right. And I started to realize like all these traits that I've had from my childhood, which has also made me a great founder, right? It's like, I will go for something and keep going and keep going. Obviously contributed to what I now see as ADHD, and now I know how to manage that, right? So good example, I will never do drugs.
Sure.
I've never tried a cigarette. I now know that I'm happy to have 2 or 3 glasses of wine, but like after that, I don't want to have 10.
Go slippery slope, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, so then I guess that's it, right? Dealing with managing it and everything else from there. It's surprising, I suppose, you didn't, I don't want to say struggle at school, but like with ADHD going, you know, you went to the States for school.
Yeah.
Was that through your athletics?
Combination. I've got to be honest, I loved school. You know, I also think there's this misassumption that people with neurodiversity can't excel at school.
Mm.
Like they can, and they normally do, as long as they're guided the appropriate way.
Right.
So my first couple of years at school, I was like a little naughty. I always think naughty children are the smartest because they question things. And I think that is the most, like, I love little kids that question things. I love naughty kids. But during school, I think for me, I do have a capacity to hyperfocus. But I studied in a very different way to other people. So, you know, most people would study for 2 hours, take a break. I would do like 16-hour days without moving. You can ask my parents. For during my GCSEs, I would just sit there 7 to 11 and just study. You know, I got straight A stars in my GCSEs. Same with A-levels.
So everyone thinks you're doing a great job.
Everyone thinks I'm doing a great job, right? I did not need to be doing that. It's a memory test.
Mm.
I was studying for a memory test and I have a good memory. But I think for me, what I learned throughout education, and I think, look, I am a good student and I know that, was actually prioritization, being like, do I really need to fucking be doing this?
Mm.
And is it okay if my brain thinks in a different way?
For sure.
So, you know, I work better with 20 tabs open on my laptop than one. I need to be able to bounce between 100 in order to get them all done. And I'm okay with that. I've learned that's the way my brain works.
Amazing. So then one of the hardest things when you're a founder is balance. Pretty hard to find.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter who you are. If you love your company, you love what you do, which I know you do. It's a challenge. 16-hour days as a student. Has that translated into 16-hour days for Kanjo?
At the moment, yeah. Look, I think we have this illusion of work-life balance. It's wrong. Like, you cannot do 50-50. You can't live on a 70-30. It's going to be one or the other, right? Sometimes it's going to sway way into more, like, way more into work. Currently, we're fundraising. It's going to be more work.
Sure.
And sometimes I want to have a bit more fun, and that's okay. Currently, haven't had that for a very long time. but I think for me, and, you know, I'm really into gratitude journaling. It's changed my life, and I can go so far into that. But it's being like, can I have 3 things I'm grateful for every day that aren't work related? So what does balance look like to me? It's setting routine in a system that doesn't allow you to have one. So startups, you do not have routine, right? It's like sometimes you're an accountant, sometimes you're a lawyer, sometimes most of the time you're putting out fires. So for me, I know that every Saturday I do a long run with the same group of people. Every Wednesday and Friday, I do High Rocks. I will eat dinner at home on Mondays, but I'm always out Wednesday, Friday. Right. And whilst that seems really lame, it allows me to see my friends. It allows me to work out. And it creates, I don't know how much you know about like serotonin and dopamine, but right, dopamine, your flight and flight. that is what startups are built on, right? It's like you're suddenly like, you're going. And for ADHDers, that's like a lot of overwhelm. Serotonin is built by consistency and routine. And for me, I remember my therapist saying, she was like, you need to find ways to increase your serotonin. And I was like, how do I do that? She was like, try and eat at the same time every day. Try and sleep at the same time every day. Try and see your friends 3 times a week. Make sure you're doing the same thing, because the rest of your life is chaos. That's what balance currently looks like to me. It's like, find routine and like daily joy in the chaos.
Love it. So tech then, health trackers, you're wearing an Apple Watch.
I am. I love it.
You love it?
I love my Apple.
Does that help you with your routine and things like that?
No, it helps me with my obsession. I love it. I just track how many steps I do. Like, my watch face is literally how many steps I've done, how many hours of exercise I've done. It sounds really lame. I wanted one because my mum had one and I felt a bit jealous. I love it. But, you know, I spent my life as an athlete where we were told to track absolutely everything. So, you know, I had these kind of shoe insoles that had 28 metrics on my overpronation, underpronation, cadence. I don't think we need that many numbers to know how we feel. I don't. Like, I don't know if you've ever had this. Do you track your sleep?
Well, I got my Whoop on.
Oh God, not
I also do have an Apple Watch when I work out. I think it's been, for me personally, it's been really useful for like a couple of years to help me with my habit tracking and to let me know maybe things that I already feel like I did know. For me, the biggest one, sleep consistency.
Yeah.
So that just really highlighted to me how important going to bed at the same time was, getting up at the same time was. Never had trouble with getting up at the same time, but going to bed at the same time is so hard. If anyone who is listening tries to go to bed at the same time, let's say it's 10:30 p.m. every night, so challenging.
You can't do it.
So challenging. But that's one thing that I've definitely noticed. Like, so when I do go into a routine, kind of what you said, and I really resonate with that, you know, Monday do this, Wednesday do that, like Thursday play football, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday go to the gym,
yeah.
Friday night's date night, whatever that may look like, Saturday night's football, Sunday night's family, right? For me, I have that routine in my mindset, and I really like that. And sometimes when people throw me the curveball, I'm a bit like, ooh, like, yeah. Not sure I can make that work. But unfortunately, especially with a startup world, you kind of have to adapt.
I have a question.
Sure.
So with your Whoop,
yeah,
right? So I have this thing, and I don't know if you feel the same way, that I get the sleep tracker from my watch. And sometimes I feel like I've had a great night's sleep. And I'm like, I feel so rested. I feel so alert. I've recovered. And then my watch tells me I've had 5 hours sleep.
Right.
And then suddenly I feel like absolute shit.
Yep.
Do you ever get that?
Yep. 100%.
Or like you feel like you've done loads of steps and then you check your watch and you're like, I haven't done it.
Yeah. So data is awesome for a lot of the time, but it can be your biggest crux in how you feel. So like with the Whoop, it tells you about your recovery. Now, recovery is easy to confuse with how you should feel.
Yeah.
So you got the two main scores on it, which are three main scores on it, which are strain, sleep, and recovery. So actually how you feel is not strain or recovery. It's more around how like amount you sleep.
Yeah.
So it refers to sleep debt and how much you should sleep. And if I've got 100% sleep, I'm more likely to feel better.
Yeah.
Rather than it might say, oh, you're like really non-recovered, which is not telling you how you should feel. What that's saying is yesterday you went on 2 times runs or you went to the gym and you went for a run or something. So therefore your muscles took a high strain and therefore you're unrecovered.
Yeah.
But when you do wake up and it's 8:30 in the morning and you check and you type out your journal on Whoop and it tells you you're like 30% recovered. And I'm like, oh, I feel really good.
Yeah.
But the hours after that, you do sometimes feel over-datified. I don't know if that's a word.
No,
but
I totally think
completely overwhelmed by that amount of data, because you suddenly go, oh, well, it's telling me that I should feel like shit.
Yeah.
So there is some negatives.
Totally.
But
I mean, I feel like that with biohacking quite a lot.
Yeah.
Right. I'm someone who I've literally, if you think about my time in mental health and health, it's my entire life. But you know, I think a good example, look, I see so much about, like, you know, like Brian Johnson, like all these people with their biohacking stuff. And at some point, you just the best thing humans have capacity for is intuition. And I like truly believe that. Like, I really do. And I remember my mum's weight hasn't changed in 30 years at all. She eats whatever she wants. She exercises sometimes. She walks the dogs. And I was like, how do you like manage to like, you know, track your blood, track your macros and do this? And she was like, I just go by how my jeans fit. And I was like, what do you mean? She was like, you know, she's 60. She's remarkably healthy, looks about 40. And I was like, I don't want us to lose that. Right. You know, sometimes I, on my watch or whatever, you know, I have used the Whoop too. It will say I'm 100% recovered, but I might have broken up with my boyfriend.
Sure.
Right. Or I might have had a really shitty day at work and I just want to eat a fucking burger and not exercise. And we need to allow ourselves space to like still be human. And I think, you know, kind of going back to why I built Kanjo was like, I don't want to take away the human element of clinical practice. I just want clinical practice to like catch up to where clinical research is.
Mm, 100%. Let's talk about running then. So
yeah,
former athlete, couple of gold medals in the back locker.
Yeah.
You can run us through that. But talk us through that. Talk us through how it helped you maybe in your early stages of your life, but also then link it back to today. I know you still run like every day. It must help with everything, but yeah. Run us through how you find it super important.
Yeah. So when did I start running? Well, I actually started off as a swimmer. So I was swimming pretty competitively by the age of 8. I was kind of that kid that you could put into any sport and I would somehow be very good. And I don't like, thank you genetics to my parents. But I was 7, I think it was 7 or 8. And there was a Camden cross country race and it was a mile. And I won the race by 1/2 mile. I just liked it. Like, I did not think, won it by 1/2 mile. This guy comes up to my parents and they were like, you know, your daughter's going to be a very good runner. And they were like, yeah. We'll like get her doing some runs a couple of times a week. Started running and I fucking hated it. I was like, this is so boring. And my dad would get me running and I was like, this shit like sucks. So I kind of just like toddled around sometimes, ran a bit. And then I hit like 11 or 12. I was in, you know, year 7. And I just like kept winning races. And I was like, it's actually quite fun. I quite like this. Kept doing it for a while and then my eating disorder hit. At that point, I was not best in the country. Like, I was better than average, probably top 50 in the country for my age, but I was not on any magazines. I was not particularly special. And during my eating disorder, I stopped doing everything I loved. Like, I stopped running completely. I wasn't allowed to walk to school, ever. I wasn't allowed to eat unaccompanied.
Wow.
Yeah, it like my friends would have to text my mum if I did or did not eat my pear at 10 a.m. And you start realizing like how much you love the things you lose. And I was like, God, I really miss running. Like, I really miss it. And around the time, probably midway through my eating disorder, I got this letter from the World Athletics Federation being like, we want you to come and compete at trials for Worlds. And I was like, probably not good enough for this. And I said to my mum, I was like, if I can be the best at losing weight, I'm going to be the best at gaining it. And something just like clicked in my head where I was like, I'm really fucking good at something here. Like, I have potential. So I ended up spending 6 to 7 months eating 7,000 calories a day.
Wow.
Yeah. And I know you probably think, whoa, that's like dream eating. It is the most horrible thing you can do. It is force feeding yourself 24 hours a day. So I'd start every morning with a 700 calorie weight gain shake, straight to a dessert before breakfast. And I'd have a weight gain shake next night.
Sounds fun for like a day.
Honestly, no, like not at all. And because you kind of go into the state of like hyper metabolism, I would eat 6,000 calories a day and lose weight. Wow. It was awful.
Wow, man.
But I came back and got back into running. And by the end of the year was like number one in the UK for steeplechase, number two in 5,000. And I was like, I love this shit. And I'm not going to run through the accolades or like,
sure.
I was number two in Europe. like, I'm not going to run through all the accolades of like where running took me. But I think like it taught me a few things that I can certainly apply to work. And I think weirdly not to do with, you know, I'm good at team, that shit. I think everyone can speak to, you know, what's your greatest weakness? And everyone says, I work too hard. I think one of the big things is making sure you have stuff outside of work. So when you are an athlete, there is such a high likelihood of you getting injured. So when I was at college, I had like 8 stress fractures. I was having steroid injections in my spine. Jesus. Yeah, it was fucking awful. It was really bad. I spent more time in a boot than out of one.
Oh my word.
Yeah. And I made sure that I had created this incredible group of friends outside of running. You know, I was the editor of a school magazine. I was starting my tech company and I was like, if this all falls apart, who is Sophia outside of running? And I think when it came to work, you know, at the moment, I'm definitely like, there is no Sophia outside of work. But there is a Sophia outside of work who, you know, is a daughter, is a partner, is a really good friend who loves running. And, you know, there is so much more to me than what I've built. And that has been like the strongest lesson that, like, you know, sometimes shit's really going to fucking hit the fan and you will need to step back for a few hours. Who am I going to be in those few hours? And I think that was probably the biggest lesson, except for like, just you're going to keep getting hit with shit and you just got to like eat it and get back up. Like that was the other one, right? Is you like, you only become the best by being the worst for a long time.
Love it. But also it gave you a good understanding of what it was like to win. And you got pretty good at it. So what's winning to you today?
You know, like every founder is going to say an exit, right? And like, yes, my job is to, you know, create money for myself and create money for our investors, returns, blah, 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 blah. There are a lot of other ways I see winning. One, can all my team come in happy and excited to work? I think that might have been the biggest change I've seen this year. I have never seen a more hardworking team that are so happy to be there. As in, you know, it's Good Friday this Friday. And I said to everyone, I was like, please take a day off. Basically, I want a day off. And they were like, no, we want to work on Friday. And I was like, you don't have to work. And they were like, no, we love coming in. And I was like, I have created a culture that means this company will succeed because it's not just me anymore. It's like this entire unit. That for me is winning. Two is actually creating impact. And I think, you know, there's this misillusion that you can't be an impactful company and make money. You can do both. And like the third for me is like, I think winning for me is never being settled. That's like a really weird thing. I don't think I'm ever going to win. Right? As in, winning isn't an exit, because after the exit, you're going to be into another company and you're going to be running that. And winning isn't, you know, closing this round, because as soon as I'm done with that, I have to hire someone else. And I think, you know, it's really funny, you know, you hear a lot of stories of people when they exit being quite sad after, being like, oh, I thought I'd have this aha moment. So for me, it's like, can I break down winning into these like incremental small wins and like be very aware of them every day?
Mm.
So, you know, my wins in the last 2 weeks was, you know, we got another 700,000 of commitments, like, and they might not seem like a giant win, but to me, I'm like, that is four people that believe that we're going to change the world.
Awesome.
You know, another win is that we rearranged our desks in our office and now everyone can see each other every day. Right. But if you actually add up all those wins, you're like, holy shit, we have done so much.
Yeah, it's amazing. I love it. And the company culture, I'd like to touch on in a minute, but you're fundraising right now. Your not so favorite thing to do, but a necessary must.
Yeah.
You've also fundraised before.
Yeah.
Any top tips?
Can I be honest? I always go, kind of enjoy it.
Okay.
No, there's so much fun of it that you get to meet to smart people and sell your company. And like, I'm a glorified saleswoman, but it's very tiring. My top tips are, I don't think I'm the best person to give top tips, but I think I spoke to this yesterday with a friend who's a VC, and she was like, you pitch really well. And I was like, what do you mean? She was like, I just understood the problem. And I think one thing is you can use all these large technical terms, and I'm sure you can raise some money if you're an AI, blah, 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 for HR. But if people don't know the problem or empathize with the problem, you've kind of lost them from the beginning.
Mm.
Right? So, you know, the people that are predominantly invested in this round are parents who have children with ADHD. They get it, right? And my job is like, I want you to feel that pain and I want you to understand how big this problem is. I think that would be the first. I think number two is actually share the load with your team. I never did that. My first round, I was like, this is all on me. And if I can't fundraise and the company goes to shit, it's all on me. Totally different this time. Like, I tell everyone what's going on at every minute, how the call went. Does anyone have an opinion on this? Can anyone do this? You know, we now do team breakfasts every 2 weeks where I run them through where we are. There's like no secrecy. And I think, you know, we have a habit when we get rejected to like internalize it, not share it. And I'm like, hey guys, this was the feedback I got from this. Have you overheard me doing this? Or would you guys like to hop on this call and maybe explain this better to someone? See, now it's not just me on calls. Most of the time it is, but you know, our CTO steps in, our head of ops steps in, our data science. And I was like, that's what teamwork looks like, right? Is share, like, you can only get better at something if you acknowledge that you can do better. And I think that's a big problem, is they're like, oh, they just don't get it. There is a reason these people don't get it. Sometimes it's because they're not the right fit. Sometimes you're doing it wrong.
Mm, for sure.
Right.
Yeah, 100%. So then if you're looking back at the team culture we mentioned earlier, you rely on your team now, maybe something you could have done or should have done earlier on when you were fundraising, as you mentioned. Team culture, obviously, super important. But made any mistakes? How would you sort of put it in the bubble today that you've made some successes there?
I have made so many mistakes. And I, how much can I say of this publicly? we will discuss what can be cut and not. So me and my first co-founder broke up about 8 months ago. He was brilliant about it. He gifted back the majority of equity. He's still an advisor to the company. But I think ultimately, you know, we think compatibility in co-founding as, you know, and I went through EF, as you get on really well. In general terms, not in startup terms. It's like you get on really well and you both have this huge vision of how you're going to change the world. But actually compatibility is kind of in startups. Like, are you opposites? Right. Like, can I do the shit you can't and can you do the shit I can't?
Or don't want to.
And don't want to, right? So like, I'm not the biggest product person, if I'm honest. And my co-founder currently absolutely does not like sales.
Right.
Or fundraising. And I love it.
So you're happy to be the face right now? You've always been the face.
I love being the face. Except my team currently says that's my role. And I'm like, I would not, I'm a bit more than the face of a company.
Former Instagram influencer.
Sophia PW underscore runs. Sad Instagram name. But I think, yeah, that was a mistake of mine, was thinking that just because you're very good friends means you can build a company together. It doesn't work like that. And then for me, not being able to express when things went wrong. So, you know, me and my co-founder have like couples therapy at the moment.
Love it.
It's awesome.
It's a marriage.
It is
at the end of the day.
It literally functions as a marriage. And my biggest downfall, not my former co-founders, not my current one, is shit at giving feedback. Like terrible. Or was. So I felt like if I offended someone, they would run away. And I was like, oh my God, I can't build this alone. What if this person leaves because they're so amazing that they could just go and get another opportunity if I tell them they're wrong.
So you didn't give the feedback because you were scared of them potentially moving on.
Yeah, it's like a fear of abandonment.
Sure.
Don't know where it comes from because I have, you know, two happy parents. And I've never been like abandoned, but I was petrified of it. So I kind of like held my tongue. And, you know, we had various team members come in that were very gaslighty with me, telling me I wasn't good enough to be a leader despite me paying their salary, or that I was too young. Like, it has happened.
Wow.
And I just held my breath because I was like, if I say something, they're gone. At that point, I probably should have realized they are not good for the job.
Sure.
And I'm going to find someone much better. And, you know, I have a culture with my team now that as soon as I think something is wrong or they could have done it better, I will tell them straight away. Because if I don't do that, they can't do that with me. That's a big part, right? Is I am going to be making more mistakes than they are. And if I can't create a culture where I can give them feedback, who's going to be giving me my feedback?
100%.
Yeah.
100%. Yeah. Like, it's like open door policy, right?
Yeah.
It's like, if you show them that they can come to you and they can walk through that door and give you that feedback or share their concerns or feelings with you, then you've got to be able to do that back to them as well. It can't be just one way abruptness of, you know, X, Y, Z's wrong, do better. It can actually go the other way if it's done in the right way with the right setup. So that's today. You've built a company over the last few years. You have expanded internationally.
Yeah.
You are making some serious moves in the mental health sort of industry. What's next?
We're going to keep going. Do what we always do, right? I think, like, if everyone says, where are you going to be in 5 years? If I, like, and, you know, I draw up this financial model and I say, you know, this is the number. That's all arbitrary, right? Like, numbers are arbitrary. Until the point they're not, and that's probably going to be series B plus. Right now, we are on track to solve, you know, the vision and the problem we have of the world is we want to solve the pediatric mental health crisis. Everything we are doing is tailored towards that. If we can keep doing that, that is what's next. Right, and that means raising this round, investing more in AI and data science, hopefully bringing on a salesperson because I can't keep doing the macro economy flights weekly. And basically just committing to what we're building and doing it better and better every day. And I think, you know, I hate the quote, but it does make a lot of sense. But like, the best you can do is just being better than where you were yesterday. And that's what our team is doing. It's every day I notice, I was like, oh my God, we are so much better than we were a week ago and so much better than we were a month ago. And I hope I look back in a year now and I look at this and I was like, oh, how sweet. Like, you know, I didn't even have answers to what our ARR is going to be. And I'm like, boom, I can give you the numbers.
Absolutely love it. And with all those people hopefully listening, where can they find you?
Well, not the old Instagram, that's for sure. Unless you want to see like videos of me like squat jumping. my name is my Instagram. My name is my LinkedIn. My name is my Facebook. Do you use Facebook?
I don't use Facebook anymore.
I don't, except there is a very good PR group for founders, by the way. Just saying. I will give that tip at some point, but it's a secret one. Honestly, you can type my name into Google and find me pretty much everywhere, because one thing I never realized is some of your life should remain private. Don't know if you ever had that, but everything I did when I was young was very public. So now anybody on the internet can read about my eating disorder, you know, my favorite meals, my feelings towards my family on my blog. Not good, but it's there.
All learnings. All amazing. Find you on LinkedIn. You do, like I, have quite a distinctive surname. therefore, people can find you quite well. So, Sophia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You have been my everyday founder. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Everyday Founder. If you haven't already, like or subscribe wherever you are watching or listening to this episode. If you know of an incredible founder that story needs to be shared, then let me know who you would like to see next on The Everyday Founder via the comment section or messaging me on LinkedIn. These episodes are brought to you by Shake Content, your LinkedIn content agency. So please show them support on all socials so that we can keep bringing you amazing guests and sharing their stories on The Everyday Founder.